In the afternoon tomorrow, a high of 50, some winds up to 25 miles per hour. Right now, wind west at 10. It is sunny and 39 degrees in Racine, 38 in Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. As I'm sure you know by now, yesterday's Super Bowl 57 featured a seesaw battle between the Kansas City Chiefs and the Philadelphia Eagles, with the Chiefs ultimately coming out on top 38-35. One thing that made this contest especially distinctive and even historic was that the two starting quarterbacks were both black. Patrick Mahomes for the Chiefs, Jalen Hurts for the Eagles. It is not all that long ago, in fact, it's within my own lifetime, that such a notion would have been all but unthinkable. That is, not that long ago, it was very, very difficult for many Americans to wrap their heads around the idea of a black man being capable of serving as quarterback for a leading team, particularly in the professional ranks. That, of course, has thankfully and dramatically changed in recent years. Jason Reed has written a fascinating book about that called Rise of the Black Quarterback. In fact, he was interviewed by NPR's Morning Edition just before Super Bowl 57 to talk about the spectacle of two black quarterbacks squaring off in America's greatest game. I thought it was good timing to replay the conversation which he and I recorded several months ago. Here it is, sports writer Jason Reed, author of the book Rise of the Black Quarterback. I want to say that one of the things that made my eyes kind of light up as I saw the title of your book, upcoming book, is that I happen to be once upon a time a Pittsburgh Steelers fan. Now I'm a Green Bay Packers fan, but back in junior high and high school, and just by pure dumb luck, I became a Steelers fan just as they were beginning their ascent with Terry Bradshaw. But of course, in the mix, in those first years when the Steelers were finally successful for the first time, one of their quarterbacks was a black quarterback by the name of Joe Gilliam. And he was not on the scene very long. But I remember as a young person thinking, this is something rare. It's something you very, very seldom saw at that point in time in the early 1970s. So I'm glad that Joe Gilliam's mostly sad story is part of this cavalcade of notable black quarterbacks whom you examine and profile in your book. What kind of a monumental undertaking was this?
Well, you know, the book, I think this is the first book I've ever written. And, you know, from speaking to friends of mine who've written books, like the first one, and a chance to do more of them, they have to be things that you're passionate about, and they have to be things that you really want to spend a lot of hours on, you know, trying to make as full as you possibly can. And I've always been interested in history, and you know, back in 2019, I went to my editors at ESPN, and I told them that I wanted to examine black quarterbacks that season, because that was actually the 100th season of the NFL. The NFL was commemorating its 100th anniversary in that season, and it just seemed to me, from talking to people, that black quarterbacks who had been historically among the most marginalized players in the NFL had risen to a point at that point where it was no longer, you know, an oddity to see a black quarterback. You talked about your experience growing up, you know, as a Pittsburgh Steelers fan, and Jefferson Street Joe Gilliam. It was such a just a strange thing, really, for lack of a better way to put it, to see a black man playing quarterback in the NFL in the 1970s. But by 2019, things had gotten to a point where black quarterbacks were on the verge of having the greatest seasons they had ever had. And the juxtaposition of the 100th season of the NFL, I just thought there was something there. Well, as it turned out, Lamar Jackson of the Baltimore Ravens won the NFL MVP award. He was only the second unanimous winner of that award as a quarterback. He joined Tom Brady in that category, the legendary quarterback who's now at the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. You had Patrick Mahomes lead the Kansas City Chiefs to the Super Bowl, and he won the Super Bowl MVP award. You had Russell Wilson have another great season with Seattle. He probably, if the award had not been won unanimously by Lamar Jackson, Russell Wilson would have been second in that voting. You had Kyler Murray, who was the number one overall draft pick coming into that season, who won the AP Rookie of the Year award. And then Dak Prescott with the Dallas Cowboys had a great season. So as it turned out, black quarterbacks did have an unprecedented season. And after the season, it's funny, I was actually in my Uber going to the airport after the Chiefs had defeated the San Francisco 49ers in Miami at the Super Bowl, and I'm in my Uber going back, and I got a couple of calls from book agents who told me they'd be following my season-long series, and they thought there was a book here. Well, as it turned out, there was a book here.
That's for sure. I mean, it's an amazing book, and you explore so much here, and I so deeply appreciate the care with which you've told this important story. And of course, you're absolutely right. We're getting to a point now where it almost seems ludicrous to even talk about a black quarterback in the NFL, as ludicrous as we would say, oh, he's a black wide receiver. I mean, it's to the point now where there are so many luminaries, and they are becoming a dominant presence, and also, in a sense, kind of a normal presence in the NFL in a way that would have been unthinkable a half a century ago. One of my questions is, why do we, generally speaking, know so little about the start of this compared to, for instance, the way in which just about all of us know who Jackie Robinson was? How is it that the start of this particular story is so obscure for just about all of us?
Well, you know, that's a great point, that it is really obscure, that you know, many of these people have been lost to history. And I think part of the reason why is that when we look at the emergence of the NFL as the dominant sports league in America and really the most powerful and successful sports league in the history of professional sports, it was a journey that was many decades in the making. And by the, you know, we know so much about Jackie Robinson because, remember, back in the 1940s and the 50s and even, you know, into the 60s, Major League Baseball was the dominant sport in America. So when you look at the NFL really wasn't, it didn't have as many eyeballs on it. So, you know, we can go back to the start of the NFL back in 1920, and, you know, we have Fritz Pollard, who's the first black star player in the NFL, and he actually winds up being the first black coach, and he's also the first black quarterback. Now, quarterback looked much different back then, but he did line up at quarterback. And then we have to go really all the way to 1968 to see Marlon Briscoe, who's the first black quarterback of the modern era. So really there was so much time there, and including in this time is a 12-year ban where African Americans were not allowed to play in the NFL, that the country wasn't focused on that league in the way that it was hyper-focused on Major League Baseball. And I think that has a lot to do with the fact that we don't know, or at least I hope we know now after people read this book, that many people aren't aware of the stories of the players who came before the Patrick Mahomeses and the Lamar Jacksons of the world.
And you are serving all of us so well by telling us these important stories. For any of you joining us, I'm speaking with Jason Reed, author of the brand new book, Rise of the Black Quarterback, What It Means for America. You touched on the name of Marlon Briscoe, and his story is particularly interesting, and of course also a story which we read with frustration, if not outright rage, in terms of the way in which he was treated by the Denver Broncos and their head coach at the time. First of all, describe the high quality of his rookie season with the Denver Broncos and the circumstances under which he even started as their quarterback.
Yeah, Marlon's story is really one of my favorite chapters in the book, but also probably the saddest chapter in the book. Marlon Briscoe was a star quarterback at the University of Nebraska, Omaha. Not a big school, and he didn't fit the prototypical size of a quarterback. Marlon was 5'9", 5'10", maybe 175 pounds, dripping wet. And you know, back in 1968, when Marlon was entering the NFL, well, at the time, the AFL draft, the old AFL before the AFL and the NFL merged, black men were not being drafted to play quarterback in either of the two major professional football leagues in the country at that point. If a black quarterback in college was good enough or considered good enough by the NFL and AFL to make it to the pros, that player understood he would just have to change positions. Black quarterbacks were changed to be wide receivers. They were changed to be cornerbacks predominantly. Other positions as well. You know, some would be running backs, some would be safeties. But the reality of it is you knew you had to change positions. Well, the Broncos drafted Marlon in the 14th round of the AFL draft. You know, he's a low-round draft pick, but they thought he had potential at cornerback. Well, Marlon throws him a curveball. He says, I won't sign as a cornerback unless you give me a trial at quarterback. And the team thought he was being ridiculous, but they, you know, they played along. The process was completely rigged, of course. I mean, he never had a chance to actually, no matter how well he performed, actually be the team's quarterback. But he did, by all accounts from researching the book, perform well. And, you know, Marlon told me when we sat down for an interview, like, no, I did very well. But he knew that he wouldn't get the job. So anyway, what happened was, the starter of the team at quarterback winds up getting hurt. Other players are ineffective. The team gets off to a bad start. So they throw Marlon in there because, you know, they don't think, okay, there's nobody better, and, you know, they're not having a good season anyway. Well, you know, shockingly to the people around the team, Marlon played very well, and he sets a Denver Broncos rookie record, which still stands today, for touchdown passes. He finishes high in the AFL Rookie of the Year voting. And he goes home to Omaha to work on his degree and gets a phone call from someone in Denver who tells him that, hey, just to let you know, they're having quarterback meetings out here. And Marlon's like, well, that's impossible. I'm the quarterback. They couldn't do that. Comes to find out that the team took the job away from him. No reason was given. Marlon told me that later he had heard that management was concerned about how white fans would react to him being the quarterback moving forward. You know, that it was one thing when they were having a bad season and throw him in there as emergency. It was quite another to start a season with him there. So the team winds up releasing him. Marlon reinvents himself as a wide receiver, and he has a very good career moving forward as a wide receiver with the Buffalo Bills, goes to the Miami Dolphins, gets traded there, wins a couple of Super Bowls, was on the Miami Dolphins undefeated team with Don Shula as the head coach. And you know, he goes on to after retirement from the NFL, Marlon was always good with numbers, and he winds up making a good living in the financial industry. But his story takes a turn because he gets hooked on drugs, and he winds up going to jail. And you know, Marlon told me that he will never blame his drug addiction specifically on what happened to him, that this job that he loved, that he proved he could do, was taken away from him. But that was that did create a hole in him. And it was taken from him for no other reason than racism. And when we talk about like pioneers, like we have to talk about Marlon Briscoe, who many people have never heard that name. But Marlon Briscoe really was the first one to get the door open, and sadly, it was taken away from him.
Hmm. And of course, your book is not only about stories that are laced with those kind of indignities, but ultimately, your book tells stories of greater success achieved by the likes of course, Warren Moon and Michael Vick and Doug Williams and many, many others, to say nothing of the spectacular young black quarterbacks who are such an integral part of the NFL today. One of the things your book does, of course, is helps us understand what that attitude was all about. That is, that attitude that shut out blacks from the position of quarterback at a time when they were welcome to play other positions. And you make a very persuasive case for this really coming down to a gross misunderstanding of the leadership qualities of the typical black man. Tell us more about what the fears were of, for instance, coaches and owners in terms of if a black man was given the reins of a quarterback, of a team as their quarterback.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it seems crazy now what I'm about to say, but the prevailing belief among the people who held the marionette strings in the NFL for most of NFL history was that black men were just inherently inferior to white men and lacked the intelligence, the leadership capability, the toughness, the courage to succeed at the most important position in all of team sports. And they and even more importantly, simply could not lead white men. And the quarterback is the leadership position. It's the position that everything flows from. And so you had team owners and club executives and head coaches all thinking that if you put a black man at quarterback, your team would fail, that there was no other way around this, that blacks simply could not handle the rigors of the position, the things that you had to do on a day in day out basis to succeed. And I've been doing a lot of interviews around the book, obviously, and some people have said to me, well, you know, that just seems like such a crazy notion. But we've got to remember that for most of American history, there's been a belief among, you know, many white people that black people, you know, from, you know, we can go from slavery to Jim Crow to you know, the emergence of the civil rights movement, you know, in a very large scale in the 1960s, that many white people felt that black people were inferior. And so it stands to reason that the white owners of the NFL, the white coaches, because there were no black coaches, there were no black owners. So it stands to reason that this would be the kind of mood of the day. And it's when you look at these superstar black quarterbacks right now, it's really difficult for people who don't know the history of it to even understand, well, you know, that doesn't make any sense. Well, you know, how could you even say that? But this was, in fact, the case.
One of the questions that came to my mind as I was reading about that and thinking about that terrible assumption, of course, that coaches and owners alike were making about black men and their capabilities, it made me wonder, in a terrible sort of way, did they have a point in the sense that what about white players on a given team and their willingness to follow a black man as quarterback? At the time that this was becoming a viable possibility, what is your sense of the presence on the roster of NFL teams of racist white players who would have been offended at the notion of being led by a black quarterback? Or do you think there was not much of that, and was this just a sadly outmoded, gross misunderstanding on the part of coaches and owners?
You know, you're the first person who's asked me that, and I'm glad you did. I think, you know, from all the interviews, and let me go take this back to Marlon Briscoe. You know, I asked Marlon, well, did you feel that your teammates, and, you know, many of his teammates were white, did you feel that your teammates did not, you know, respect you, did not? And he's like, no, I mean, that was the great thing about it, that obviously ownership had that fear, the coaches had that fear, but he told me that, like, when he finally got in there, because he didn't start the season in that job, it wasn't until there were events where the starter got hurt and other people weren't effective, he got in there, but he didn't start the opening game there. But he told me that the sense he got, and, you know, look, let me preface this by saying no one knows what people say, you know, behind our backs.
Right.
But he told me that the sense he got of it was that, at least in the huddle and at least, you know, in a public display, that his white teammates did support him. He never felt that the offensive line didn't block for him. He never felt that, you know, white players at running back or receiver didn't catch for him. He felt like he was respected. Now, having said that, as we look at just the overall feeling about this, I'm sure that if there had been multiple black quarterbacks starting it, yeah, I would not be surprised if several of those quarterbacks' teammates would have had problems with that. Because, look, if we just look at the odds, if you have people in America in the 1960s, and when I say people, I'm talking about white people. If you have white people in the 1960s who have these views that black people are inherently inferior, and I would submit that those views were much more accepted during that time. Well, just the odds say that there would be football players who hold those same views. But, you know, we can't test the theory because Marlon was the only one.
Hmm. It's an interesting what if, isn't it? Well, at any rate, your book, of course, tells us the story of, for instance, Warren Moon, the great quarterback of both the Oilers and the Seahawks, who I think, if I understand correctly, coming out of his distinguished career at the University of Washington, did not necessarily feel like he was going to be welcomed in the NFL as a quarterback, which is why he took his great talents to the CFL and only eventually back to the NFL. Am I remembering that correctly?
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, the thing that's just so insidious about that situation is that Warren Moon was the co-player of the year of his conference as a senior. He helped the University of Washington win the Rose Bowl, a very prestigious Rose Bowl game, and he winds up not getting drafted. I mean, because the year he came out in 1978, the year he came out of college, black men still, on a large scale, black men basically were not being drafted to play quarterback in the NFL. So he had to go to Canada if he wanted to continue his career as a quarterback. He goes to Canada, he thrives. He becomes a record-setting passer in Canada. He wins championships. Eventually, the NFL can't deny that this guy is, you know, pretty good. And he signs as a free agent with the Houston Oilers. He struggled his first year, but after that transition period, he takes off. He becomes a perennial Pro Bowl player. He finishes high in the NFL MVP voting. He has a great career, and he actually winds up being the only black quarterback enshrined in the Pro Football Hall of Fame. But, you know, the thing that's just so sad about that situation is if the people who were running the NFL had been more open-minded, Warren Moon, all those years he was up in Canada, if he had been playing in the NFL all those years, he might own every single passing record there is right now. But because he started in the Canadian Football League and had to spend so many years there, by the time he got to the NFL, you know, he was later in his career. He still had a great career in the NFL, which shows how talented he actually was. But what could have been, you know? We talk about the what ifs and the what could have been, and I think Warren Moon is a perfect example of that.
Very much so. Among the array of stunningly talented black quarterbacks in the NFL today, of course, we have Patrick Mahomes and Russell Wilson and Dak Prescott and Lamar Jackson and Kyler Murray, and of course the Deshaun Watson, who is making headlines for exactly the wrong reasons with his recent NFL 6-game suspension. But by and large, when you look at this current crop of NFL luminaries, beyond their talent and ability and skills, how would you assess them in terms of being, first of all, the face of their teams, as quarterbacks are often thought? And that, of course, was also sometimes at the heart of the reluctance of some owners and coaches to have blacks as their quarterbacks. But how would you assess the way in which they are fulfilling those kind of roles with their teams in terms of being the face of that team and leaders that can be looked up to in more ways than one.
Yeah, you know, it's you're absolutely right that a big part of why these owners, team owners, historically did not want black men to occupy that position is because the quarterback is the face of the team. And, you know, when you're trying to market to your fans, white fans, as we discussed, these owners were very worried about white fans. You know, even if you could clear the hurdle for a team owner thinking a black man could actually succeed at that position, then owners also had to think about, well, would I even want one to succeed, because that might anger many of my white fans. So the guys you're talking about now have shown, all the things, the best traits that you would want in a franchise quarterback, and they lead their teams, and the biggest thing is that they do the things from a optic standpoint that you would want from your franchise quarterback. You know, they're leaders in the locker room. They lead on the field. They set the tone, and that's really what you want. And you know, I'd like to talk about the Deshaun Watson thing for a minute, situation rather, if you wouldn't mind.
Sure.
Because Deshaun Watson illustrates that situation, his individual situation, illustrates how far we have come. You know, there was a time in this country when if something happened with a black man, that people would say, white people would say, well, you know, that's indicative of how they are. You know, I'll never forget, you know, in researching the book, that you would I talked to old timers, and you know, they'd tell me, well, yeah, you know, they would say this person is a credit to his race, or you know, this person, you know, he shows, you know, how well black people can do this. So black people effectively were looked at as a monolith, and they were all lumped in together. The progress that we see is that we can measure the progress in terms of many different metrics, but one is that no one is out here saying that Deshaun Watson's situation in any way reflects on Patrick Mahomes, or in any way reflects on Lamar Jackson or Kyler Murray or Deshaun or Russell Wilson or Dak Prescott. That the allegations about Deshaun Watson and what the NFL is working through right now with handing down disciplinary action for those allegations, it doesn't in any way disparage what these other players are doing. And I think that's very important, because when we look at the rise of the black quarterback, it mirrors the rise of black people in the United States writ large, in the sense that black people are no longer viewed by most, okay, in a manner in which if one black person does something, well, that's what they say all black people do. And I think that's very important, that these young men are looked at and judged as individuals. They're not judged as being, you know, a collective, so to speak, in that if one person does something that is untoward or is alleged to have occurred, that somehow puts a cloud over all of them. And you know, when we talk about progress, we want people to be judged as individuals. You know, we want, you know, I think back to Martin Luther King Jr.'s speech that everybody knows. You know, he talked about being judged by the content of your character, not by the color of your skin. And inherent in that means, I am judged as an individual, not because of the amount of melanin I have.
Hmm.
And so I think it's very important that things are not perfect in this country or in the NFL. Clearly, racism still exists. But, you know, I'd be remiss if I did not acknowledge the progress that has been made. And this Deshaun Watson situation illustrates the progress that has been made.
Hmm. That's a very, very good point, one which had not dawned on me. So I appreciate you saying that. And I appreciate all that we find in the pages of your really important book, again titled Rise of the Black Quarterback, What It Means for America, published by Anscape, which is a division of ESPN. Jason Reed, congratulations on a fine book, and thank you for being my morning show guest today. It was great to talk with you.
Oh, the pleasure was mine, and thank you for having me.
You're listening to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. For part two of today's program, we're going to be focusing on one of the greatest quarterbacks ever to play the game, Tom Brady. Surely you have heard the news, even if you don't follow football very closely, that Tom Brady is retiring. It's actually the second time he's announced his retirement from the NFL, but it looks like this time he's really serious and the retirement is going to stick. I want to replay for you a portion of a really memorable conversation I had several years ago on the morning show with sports writer Casey Sherman, talking about a fascinating book called 12, The Inside Story of Tom Brady's Fight for Redemption. The book is not a standard biography of Tom Brady, although it does share plenty of interesting information about his early life and career, and reminds us that as Tom Brady was first rising through football, there was really no indication of what a superstar he was ultimately going to become. The book, however, focuses primarily on that chapter of his life and career which was more difficult than any other, that scandal that engulfed him known as Deflategate. So, it's actually the third section of the book in which you finally take on this controversy that engulfs the New England Patriots and very specifically Tom Brady. And, of course, this is a controversy that comes after at least one other very serious controversy that surrounds the Patriots. But this one very much takes aim at Tom Brady himself, a controversy that's come now to be known as Deflategate. And I think a lot of our listeners probably know at least the rough parameters of what caused this controversy in the first place. I want you to say a word about how you and your co-author have tried to approach kind of the central matter of what happened and who was guilty of what. It seems to me that you have proceeded really carefully and have tried to be fair and even-handed to all parties concerned. Say a word about what you and co-author Dave Wedge thought about in terms of handling this central aspect of the Tom Brady story.
Well, myself and my co-author were, you know, veteran investigative journalists. I've written about terrorism. I've written about organized crime. I've written about the CIA. And, you know, there are certainly elements that I've covered in my past that came to bear with this story as well, which is really what made me interested in writing this story. It really unfolds much more so like a legal thriller than it does your typical sports story. We found out that the NFL, I should say, really targeted Brady from the get-go before even investigating any of the allegations about deflated balls. They had already written their conclusion about how they wanted to tear this guy down, and that's what they did. Now, the other central character of the book is Roger Goodell, and we find him to be a fascinating character because he's very Nixonian in many ways. And, you know, we write a lot about his background, and the Nixon caricature is a bit of an irony given the fact that it was Richard Nixon that basically derailed Roger Goodell's father's political career in the early 1970s. And here you have an NFL commissioner who will do anything he can to attain power and then do anything he can to retain power. Now, you mentioned, Greg, the Spygate scandal in 2007, which was a legitimate controversy. The New England Patriots were guilty of videotaping signals from opposing teams and coaches. Now, Roger Goodell at the time, he was so close to the ownership of the New England Patriots, including Robert Kraft, that he swept that scandal and that controversy under the rug, going so far as to destroying evidence that implicated the Patriots even further. That was a Bill Belichick-fueled scandal. Brady had nothing to do with it. But the other 31 owners saw this collusion, and I use that word because we hear it so often now, between Goodell and Kraft, and they said, okay, if there's anything untoward about the Patriots moving ahead, you have to go after them with both fists. Now, there's a very Shakespearean theme to the story as well, because Robert Kraft really groomed and mentored Goodell and really put him into his position as commissioner of the NFL. And here is Roger Goodell. He has got to weigh this decision to go after his friend, to go after his father figure. You know, Kraft really mentored him, and I think Goodell looked at him as a father figure. And but in order to keep his power, he had to metaphorically slay his father, and that's what he did. He was willing to do that to keep his job.
So I was about to ask you, what possible motivation could there be for Mr. Goodell to go after Tom Brady in this way? I mean, there are plenty of NFL fans who hate the Patriots and who would love nothing more than to see something like this occur. But somebody like Roger Goodell, of course, is not going to take action because of that kind of personal animosity. So in your mind, this was all about him keeping his job and salvaging good relations with all of the other owners of the NFL.
Oh, that's right. I mean, that's where his motivation, you know, began. And it was interesting. We write, as you've read, Greg, how the NFL investigators put their chess pieces in play well before the actual football game where the Patriots were accused of deflating footballs. It was really a sting operation from beginning to end. Normally, if a team is accused of any equipment violation, they are going to get a fair warning from the league in the days leading up to the game to say, hey, we're watching for this. Make sure it doesn't happen. The Patriots weren't given any indication that this was even a possibility, and all of the lead investigators of the entire league were at Foxborough Stadium, Gillette Stadium, the night in question to allegedly catch the Patriots in the act. It's also interesting to know that there has been, in the history of the NFL, never a time that footballs had been measured during the game. It was such a minor rule in the rule books that nobody had even thought about it. Your fans obviously understand, you know, the greatness of Aaron Rodgers. And, you know, Aaron came out very publicly defending Brady, initially saying, I like my footballs, you know, inflated even beyond the PSI limit because that's how I like to throw them. Now, the league was always notorious for either over-inflating or deflating footballs, and Brady was really frustrated by it because they would always overinflate his balls. So I think his equipment guys understood this. Brady said, I like my balls a certain way. Wasn't really colluding with his equipment managers. They did what they did, and all of a sudden you've got, you know, one of the biggest scandals in American history.
You tell us that there was all kinds of evidence that was cited about this, including lots of exchanges between various figures on the Patriots staff and so on. And it's an interesting sort of paper trail, mostly an electronic paper trail, but obviously we're talking very much about circumstantial evidence. And then, of course, a 243-page report comes out in which somebody is takes aim at the NFL's case and tries to kind of sort out if there's anything here. Was there anything there at all? I mean, was there reason to have these suspicions, or was this all completely a construction or fabrication?
Well, it was a fabrication or an amplification of an equipment violation. You know, were the equipment managers of the New England Patriots complicit in deflating balls? I think so. I think the text and trail certainly leads to that assumption, at least from a journalist like me. I think Brady was an unwitting accomplice to it all. And quite frankly, you know, Brady bears responsibility for this as well this way. He could have gotten up in front of the media right away and deflated the situation himself by saying, I like my footballs, you know, a certain way. I didn't know it was an equipment violation. You know, what fine do I have to pay? Normally, a violation like that would only elicit a $10,000 fine to somebody's charity. Instead, he dug his heels in, and it's always the cover-up that's bigger than the crime. And I think that's really what fueled this. I think the NFL was was going to target Brady regardless, but it certainly gave them momentum and venom to go after him with everything that they have, unjustly, in my opinion.
It was interesting. I thought that one of the most intriguing matters of texts involving some of these equipment managers is when they're talking about the free stuff they want to get. And at one point, one of them uses the nickname Deflator. Come help the Deflator, referring to himself, actually. And this is a term that sort of leaps out at us and makes us kind of wonder just exactly what was going on and why it was going on.
Well, it leapt out at us, too. And, the Patriots tried to spin that story by saying that that equipment manager was engaged in a weight loss program, and that was his nickname. He was deflating via his weight loss, which to us is pretty ridiculous. You know, there is deceit on both sides, small, white lies or big, blown out, lies and betrayal. And that certainly is one of those things that, these guys clearly knew what they were doing. The equipment guys, to me, are comic relief in the book because they are so pathetic, in my opinion. But again, it does. I don't want that to overshadow the bigger story, which is the NFL, the means that it will use and the lengths that it will go to control any player in the NFL. Tom Brady is the face of the entire league, and if you can bring Tom Brady under your thumb, what's that say for the seventh round draft pick of the Green Bay Packers trying to hold on to a roster spot? It shows that they are ultimately powerless against the shield of the NFL.
Say a word about the way in which the Patriots fought this, tried to fight back. I mean, you termed the story in some respects a legal thriller as much as anything else. Just how tough were the Patriots in trying to fight this? I mean, obviously, ultimately unsuccessful in those attempts, but how vociferous were those attempts to bat this away?
Initially, the owner, Robert Kraft, really came to Tom Brady's defense. He had created his own website, the Wells Report in Context, basically picking apart the league's investigation of Tom Brady. And that went on for several weeks and months, and there were threats being made that the Patriots or Robert Kraft would sue the NFL. That's certainly what fans in New England thought was going to happen, but Robert Kraft eventually said and decided to give up that fight. And we open our book with Tom Brady learning that his owner has kind of not betrayed him, but certainly not given him the support he needed. Tom Brady didn't know that Kraft was going to give up this fight, so Tom Brady, you can imagine, was very irritated and outraged by it. I think Tom Brady's coach, Bill Belichick, also threw him under the bus as well by, denouncing any idea about footballs and how the inflation rates are going. He just said, look at, the quarterback has to answer all those questions. Now, Belichick had never done that in his career. He always deflected the attention from his players, but Belichick was willing to put Brady on the spotlight. I think that's why we're seeing this fractured relationship here in New England right now between Belichick and Brady. There's no love lost there. I think Brady does not like his coach. He'll play under him because he has to, but I think that those two have a business relationship, and that's it.
In the chapter called Isolation, you explain what really happened for those four games in the fall of 2016 when quarterback Tom Brady was serving this four-game suspension. It's very, very intriguing, and I've never seen this matter written about with this kind of thoroughness at all. Describe to our listeners just what this suspension meant and how Tom Brady handled it?
Well, you know, the suspension meant that Brady could not have any contact with any player or member of the Patriots personnel for the first four games of the 2016 season. He could not. He was basically locked out of the stadium that, you know, he built, you know, with his own throwing arm. So here he is, you know, looking for fields to play on. He had his trainer, a very controversial trainer, Alex Guerrero, that has certainly been written about over the past, 12 months. Brady looked for a receiver that could emulate some of the plays that Brady knew he would be using when he got back into the game. And he began to practice on these fields. And it was, you know, the meticulousness of the way that he went about his training method was really astonishing. And the we interviewed the player that he was training with at the time, who just said, you really understand why he is the best in the business, because there's not a detail that he is not fully aware of and looking to improve upon every single time he steps back and throws a pass.
Well, the balance of your book is about Tom Brady's astonishing performance for the remainder of that 2016 season, which you term his season of redemption. And we'll kind of leave it to our listeners to explore that in all of the rich detail which you offer up. But it's safe to say that it is among the most astonishing performances by any NFL player ever.
I would say by any athlete ever as well, Greg. You'd have to go back to the fight between Muhammad Ali and George Foreman in 1974 to really, you know, find that comparison of an older athlete against a younger, stronger, faster opponent who seemingly is losing every round and suddenly summons up the will, the strength, and the determination to throw that knockout punch. Ali did it in Africa, and Tom Brady did it in the Super Bowl against the Falcons.
Incredible. Briefly, a couple of days ago, Tom Brady was back in the news again for an unhappy reason. He was giving a press briefing to reporters. It was all very cordial until a reporter asked about receiver Julian Edelman's suspension for performance-enhancing drugs. And Julian Edelman works with Alex Guerrero, who is one of the most important trainers of Tom Brady. And quarterback Tom Brady, when this question comes up, and it was actually a relatively benign question, but it apparently made him very angry, and he cut off the conference right then and there with scarcely a comment at all. Can you just say a quick word about this, and if you suspect that there is more behind this story?
Well, I mean, there's certainly more behind the story. You know, Brady should have answered that question, because Alex Guerrero just isn't Brady's trainer. He's his business partner. The whole TB12 method is something that was developed by Brady and Alex Guerrero. And obviously, Julian Edelman has been part of the program, but he also has been, you know, lifting weights, which he, I guess, is adverse to the program itself. So there's a reason that, you know, some people could tie Edelman to the TB12 method in the PED suspension, but Brady didn't want to hear it. He should have answered that question, but he didn't. And you're seeing a guy that in the twilight of his career isn't going to be that corporate guy anymore. He's showing his personal side, his anger, and his competitive spirit more so off the field now than he ever has before.
Interesting. Just makes the story of Tom Brady all the more compelling, love him or hate him. And the book we're talking about again today, 12, The Inside Story of Tom Brady's Fight for Redemption, published by Little Brown and Company, co-authored by Dave Wedge and Casey Sherman. Casey Sherman, you've done it again, yet another fantastic book. Thank you for writing it, and thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about it.
Oh, thank you, Greg. Thank you for having me.
Tomorrow on the morning show, I look forward to welcoming into our studios Dr. Peter Dene, a colleague of mine from the music faculty at Carthage. He'll be here with two of the students, two of the singers in the treble chorale that just completed a wonderful European tour. We'll hear all about it on tomorrow's morning show. Wednesday, in honor of Black History Month, Yehuru Williams and his book, Call Him Jack, a very, very illuminating look at baseball immortal Jackie Robinson and his influence beyond the baseball field. Thursday, a newcomer to the morning show, Vijay Pandian, who is with the Kenosha County UW Extension, talking about how you can start thinking and planning for your spring and summer garden now. And on Friday, a preview of the next American Experience documentary, one called Ruthless, a look at the surprise.